meaning both legislative and executive branches of government. For example, Secretary of Defense William Cohen will execute foreign policy in discussions he has with leaders in which they form or inform. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright obviously engages in foreign policy in her discussions with world leaders as well. And there's this wild stuff about Madeleine Albright in the literature and incredibly entertaining. And I'm sure you'll enjoy the moment. And we'll get to that when we start talking about the political system. The United States Trade Representative, Charlene Varchef, V-A-R-S-C-H-E-F-S-K-Y. Pretty important person when you're talking about economic sanctions. Because sanctions are often on trade policy. And the U.S. Trade Representative is an important person who negotiates these and resolves any disputes. Also, another name you need to be aware of is William Daley, because he is Secretary of Commerce. And the economic sanctions, in many cases, go through Commerce. The other series of participants that are relevant to this story would have to be those involved in Pentagon. And there's a whole slew of them. And they function on a whole series of different levels. The most of the conclusions you get about the officials of the Pentagon is they've been known to act on the basis of parochial interests, in other words, which serve their needs best. They usually have direct access to things like defense appropriations subcommittees of both the House and the Senate. And pretty much what they say happens because they know and no one else does. Armed Services Committees have been known to take short sight of certain issues, referring directly to Pentagon testimony. So they're an actor that's kind of bizarre for a call, because they can tell you anything they want. They can say, well, we've got this great new weapon, it's going to solve everything, and people tell us about it, and they go, yeah, you can't, it's like, but it's going to work, and what can you do? And so they're kind of rogue actors when you deal with, those numbers are, yeah, they are rogue actors when you deal with America's foreign policy. Bipartisanship is a useful method for overcoming President-Congress conflict in foreign policy formulation. When there's going to be obvious tension between the executive branch and the legislative branch, the solution is to establish bipartisanship in terms of maybe a bipartisan resolution coming out of Congress, which then would empower the president to engage in a series of negotiations which would produce agreement. Good example of this was in 1948, for example, when the Vandenberg resolutions were passed in Congress to actually create NATO. It was an incredibly controversial issue, and the bipartisanship that in 1948 was negotiated actually allowed NATO to be what it is today. Otherwise, it probably would have gone the same way as Wilson's League of Nations in the early 20th century, because it was incredibly confidential and it committed the United States to a substantial amount of expenditures and participation in military policy. Also, in 1963, it was the Kennedy administration that negotiated bipartisanship support for the nuclear testing treaty, which again was incredibly controversial. And what happens is the bipartisanship that's negotiated can sort of resolve some of the foundational disputes that would exist between the branches of government. And whenever really, we're talking about major policy shifts take place, they really have to be bipartisan. When you write your plans on the topic of the day, if you just do, our constructive engagement is to allow athletes from North Korea and Cuba to participate in events in the United States, right? And the economic sanction you reduce, you're eliminating is the travel restriction, right? If you do something that small, you really don't need bipartisan support. But if you do decide to eliminate all of the economic sanctions, every one of them on Iraq, yeah, good idea. You can get bipartisan support. Trust is an important factor in making relations between the two branches of government. There's good literature on this, because when the Clinton administration realized they're going to have to solve policy problems, the smart thing, and there aren't many, but the smart thing that happened was William Cohen was selected as Department of Defense Secretary, who is a Republican. How nice. Also from Congress. Right? He was a senator. And what ended up happening was his buddies were going to be voting on the policies that he was negotiating. This is really smart. Right? And so the trust factor is not something that is just thrown aside when you read about foreign policy. It's really important to have a trusted relationship between people who are negotiating foreign policy. See, The executive initiative of foreign policy is a general cabinet. Right? It's generally the President of the United States or his representative who negotiates an executive initiative of foreign policy. What the Congress can do is it has the power to propose, delay, and shape policy through a whole series of mechanisms. And some of these mechanisms are fairly important, and we'll get to them in a second. Let's talk about number one, personality. You need to know, for example, that the Senate Armed Services Committee is currently being chaired by John Warner of Virginia. Right? Strong Thurmond of South Carolina was the chair, stepped down so Warner would be the chair. Strong Thurmond is very powerful still. He's the oldest man on the planet, right? And so that Senate Armed Services Committee is incredibly important. And they're a powerful actor. They're type of personality that you want to incorporate into your bipartisan support. You also need to know that there is a subcommittee on emerging threats and capabilities in the Senate. That subcommittee on emerging threats and capabilities is currently being chaired by Senator Pat Roberts of Kansas. That is the committee that actually reviewed what the rogue nations are up to. Right? And so Pat Roberts is a powerful figure there. You also need to know that even though Warner is chair of the committee, the Democratic ranking member of the Senate Armed Services Committee is Carl Levine from Michigan. And Levine and Warner serve as ex officio committee members to all the subcommittees of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Now, these are a lot of names you're going to, but how are we going to use these for? Well, in the debate on the internal mechanics of the political disadvantages, if you have evidence that's specific about the actual actors, you win the decision. It beats Agent Trump's breath saying, oh no, there'll be a focus shift, because you'll have Senator Levine saying, no, there won't. Is the ranking Democratic member of the committee. Sounds pretty good. Senate Foreign Relations Committee is chaired by Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina, which means you'll always have a backlash position no matter what the agreement is. Right? But you need to follow his rhetoric, because his rhetoric is incredibly powerful and is very useful to the debate. It's also important to know the House Armed Services Committee, right, this is the House Committee we're talking about, the House Armed Services Committee right now is chaired by Senator Floyd Sens from South Carolina, good buddy of mine, and he does, right? And he also is incredibly radical, and you need to stay on top of who these people are, because these are the people who are the internal story of the defense, right? Some of these journalists are spinning, that's crap. But what's actually going on is what's happening in these committees. Who's talking to whom? Who are the leaders in Congress who can check the president, who can backlash against the president? And knowing these people's names makes the debate much more enjoyable to judge, because they're actually contactful. And it's not just electrostatic battles in hell. Two, procedures. Very simple. Here's what Congress can do. They can do wild stuff. First, appropriations. Congress can do anything. That's the more powerful act, really. It's an appropriations mechanism. I mean, you can be at your plan, you can get your plan in effect, we can have backlash. Backlash could be in the area of appropriations. Now, granted, you could probably win the debate that they won't cut funding to your plan, but you can't win the debate that they won't cut funding somewhere else in retaliation. And they can do that. They could do that. Yeah, you've got your plan in Iraq? Well, we're going to screw you to the wall of things. Right? And that can happen. And that's one of the mechanisms they have. Also, the Foreign Assistance Amendment. When the executive branch of the government engages in these agreements and establishes foreign assistance, which is usually the transfer of funding credits to another country, what Congress tends to do is attach amendments to it. Most of the sanctions are amendments. That's what they are. They're amendments. In other words, an export agreement has been negotiated, an Export Trade Act is passed, an amendment in it says, can't do this, that's what happens, right? It exists on that level. So it's usually an amendment that exists to a major legislation. It's also a resolution for the carriage on the protocol. E, I'll presidential campaigns. There's an election coming up. We run elections. This happens all the time, you know? And I know some of my colleagues don't like them, and I don't care. We can pretty well with them. Foreign policy has played a major role in 8 of the last 13 presidential elections. That's pretty good. I think that's really good. So 1952 to the year 2000, we've had this important issue. In 52, here's a history lesson. Eisenhower goes against Stevenson. Eisenhower runs a three-seat campaign, which is Korea, communism, and corruption. Korea's paid, but yeah. He's a good general. In 56, Stevenson decided to try one more time to take down Eisenhower, which of course was failing. And Eisenhower's vice president, who was a guy named Nixon, said, "This is not the moment to replace the greatest commander-in-chief in history." Because during that election, we had the Hungarian uprising and the Israeli, French, and English invasions of Egypt. In 1960, when Kennedy and Nixon were debating, we had the Cuba, Taiwan, and missile gas issues. In 1964, when Johnson went up against Goldwater, we had Goldwater claiming that communists were going to conquer the world and we should stop them or else we're all going to die in nuclear Armageddon. In 1968, in the Humphrey-Nixon election, we had the Vietnam War, where Humphrey said he would stop the bombing, which is kind of nice, because he was just a vice president under Johnson. And Johnson said, "Well, I will stop it in October to make sure Humphrey gets elected." But North Vietnam refused to go along and to go through the negotiations, and what ended up happening was, of course, Humphrey lost. In 1972, when McGovern went up against Nixon, we had Nixon who had gone to China, we had Nixon who had gone to the Middle East, we had Nixon who withdrew 400,000 troops out of Vietnam. In 1974, we had Ford going up against Carter, and we had that incredible statement by President Ford that said, "I don't believe the Poles consider themselves dominated by the Soviet Union." And the media spun this, and he looked like a total fool. 1980, we had Carter versus Reagan, Evil Empire, Star Wars. In 1984, we had Reagan Rumsfeld, Evil Empire, Intermediate Reduction to Nuclear Weapons. In 1988, we had Bush Dukakis. This is the tank boy thing. I don't know if you ever saw Dukakis riding in the tank. That was really cool. Also, Berlin Wall came in. 1992, it changed. This is where you start to because that was the Bush Clinton election, and there was really no foreign policy issue that dominated. In 1996, there also was no foreign policy issue. The question is, will it be an issue in the year 2000? Or have we seen a trend? And that's where the debate really takes place in the election this past. Because the last two elections weren't foreign policy elections. And you have to make the claim that the next one will be. That's a little tough. Because here's the reservation you need to know about. In the year 2000, we know we're going to have Bush and Gore. Foreign policy could become an issue if Gore's not. And I know a few people on the campaign, and he wants to put foreign policy in the election. And I'm sure that'll be on the pretty soon. Because Bush doesn't know crap about foreign policy. You know, he put foreign policy in the election, and if they get a debate on foreign policy, he's going to be a distinct advantage. Here are the reservations. Here are the things that we realize are true, and these are arguments you make against an election, he says. There has been really very much serious, responsible debate on foreign policy in the presidential campaign for quite a while. Really hasn't happened in quite a while. That debate occurs in the media. We also know that American voters are not very knowledgeable when it comes to foreign policy. They can't even tell you what workplaces are. But we also know that the electorate's interest in foreign policy very seldom goes further than a desire for peace. You know, they just want peace. But they don't, you know, they really don't want it. I mean, it's incredible how many Americans have no idea what this stuff looks like. Who are these people? Why are they so interested? I don't understand. No, it's just foreign policy issues have really been decisive in elections, according to some theory. Good news is, other foreign policy authors say that it works. And they're really bright people. They're usually these professors of political science at major universities, where they exist. And so there's a wild debate that takes place here. Yeah, it's important. No, it isn't important. Yeah, it's important. No, it isn't important. And there's often some really good reasons for it. And so you get some good debating down there. Also, foreign policy becomes an issue in presidential elections, usually, when candidates want it to be. That's a candidate's initiative. The candidate introduces it into the debate. And since Gore wants it in the debate, Gore wants it in the campaign, it's likely to appear in the campaign. Right? Because it's a strategic decision on his part. The other thing I want to talk about elections is the three-eye circuit, which I put down here. All that refers to is that there are powerful lobby groups in the United States that are based on ethnic categorization. The three eyes is a beltway term that people in campaign and elections use, referring to this entire category of interest groups. And it originally stood for Italy, Ireland, and Israel, since they were the three biggest and most powerful. But it refers to any of these ethnic groups that have coalesced to produce a strong lobby. A lobbying organization, or have a strong lobbyist in the Beltway. Roman numeral number three, theory. I teach a course in political rhetoric, so this is my backstory. I'm going to use all this stuff. When you talk about foreign policy, there are two major groups of theories. One group of theories is called the single factor analysis theory, where this is where professor political science will say foreign policy is due to this single actor. Right? There's a lot of articles written from that perspective. There's a whole other school of thought in political science, and that school of thought is called the integrative analysis school, which argues that there's no single actor. It's a confluence of actors. Right? They work together to form policy. These people say all the single factor analysis people are up for grabs. They're incredibly simplistic. You can't believe any of their conclusions. And the single factor analysis people claim that the integrative analysis people are out of touch because they're unwilling to make a stand on who or what is responsible for what. Right? So there's this battle that goes on in academia. Now the battle is probably fruitless and irrelevant, but it produces an incredible amount of useful evidence. Right? Because what happens in the debate round is somebody runs an argument that says, oh, you know, the president's going to do such and such, and Congress is going to backlash, yada, yada, yada. You go, well, that's not how things are done. And then you read a few indicts of the entire philosophy behind the disadvantage. Right? Single factor analysis theory theorists covers more camps. There's camp number one, which is the executive branch camp, which is the smart one. Because that one makes sense. The second one is the White House camp, which isn't that smart, because it pretty much says the president is the person who does it all. And we know that can't be the case, because third is staff arrangements and communication processes established by the president are responsible for foreign policy. That's interesting. I like these people. They're wild. They think that the people that get appointed are more important than the positions the government takes. And that's what you get into the matter of all roads space. There are people out there who think this woman's got to go. Right? I'm not sure how much of it is or is not sexism, but there's a lot of it that says she is making incredibly bad decisions. You know, that actually the people that we 3 years ago claimed were terrorists and should be, you know, wiped off the planet were the same ones she invited to the White House prior to the United States' decision to participate in the Costa Rica incident. So there's a lot of worse things. But it starts by just procurement problems. It's also about communication. In other words, how do people talk to each other? You know, because when you get people in the same room together and they actually start resolving disputes, you end up getting better foreign policy. That's what that group says. And the last one talks about Congress. And I just read an article, I'm not even sure it's published yet. It was in Gallup. And the article said that there are three theories that are coming out of this from the University of Texas and political science that Johnson said. New article we have. It says Congress can pass substantive legislation, which writes specific provisions into law, and that's how Congress is making foreign policy today. That's the amendment process. That's how that works. That same article says the other alternative is Congress has something called procedural legislation, which they can do. And procedural legislation is where Congress actually changes the organization's policy process, or requires the executive branch to comply with a set of rules and restrictions. These are really generic, right? I found out that after I read the article, the procedural legislation they're talking about is normally pinned on to appropriations act that passes Congress. You know, like the Department of Defense appropriations for 1999, I have some weird stuff in it. And that weird stuff impacts on these big resolutions because that weird stuff tells the executive branch how they're supposed to be able to communicate with certain world leaders on this issue. The last one is this concept called framing, which I think is a term that the Johnson people out of the University of Texas are coining. I'm sure they're going to write a whole bunch of articles on this in the next few months. Framing is a theory that says that you present an issue which captures attention and puts the issue on a foreign policy agenda by presenting the issue in a certain way. Right? The way that you really can affect foreign policy is by framing the issue appropriately, using the right language to describe the issue. You know, when you say imminent threat, you're, you know, that's so good. You know, that's important. Right? That's framing. So how do you frame it? You know, we don't talk about Kosovo war. Right? We don't use the word war. We're framing it differently. And the Johnson people say, yeah, this is kind of interesting. It's framing may have more effect on foreign policy than anything else. And John Lee and I were talking about, you know, one of the ways that you constructively engage is how you decide to talk. You know, it could be like, if I decide to talk without using certain words like growth, if I decide to talk by engaging in consensus building rather than other types of techniques, I might have a church engagement. I think that's what this brings to think about. Integrative analysis is weird. Integrative analysis, these are the people who argue that there's something called strategic policy and there's something called strategic policy. Strategic policy is oriented towards foreign policy goals. It's usually an executive decision. It deals mostly with the strength of military forces and weapons. Strategic policies, on the other hand, are the type of things that are high profile. Right? These are statement-based more than anything else. You know? And this is very similar to the framing stuff, and I think this is important. Also, the strategic policy literature out of the integrative analysis school argues that low-level bureaucrats are often more responsible for foreign policy than are the secretaries of state or the secretary of defense. That is actually people who do the work. You know, because you can make a policy decision, but actually setting up the rules and procedures are done on a bureaucratic level. And that's an interesting observation made by some of these people. I want to conclude with Roman numeral number 4. I'm not even sure if I'm going to hand it up. I'm going to call it Momentum, the Last Supercar. And what I want to talk to you about is the big buzzword. Here's the big buzzword. It came out a few days ago. It'll be in more literature. You'll find it. We're going to talk about something called blowback. Right. It's starting to appear in foreign policy literature and the rhetoric coming out of DOF and DOD. There's a lot of psychic white noise going on right now, and it has to do with the fact that, our foreign policy is really not going anywhere. According to Marshall Hirsch, he argues that you can call it the lament of the last superpower. It's not really a complaint. It's more of a psychic white noise or a typical nightmare. He says, articulated may sound like this. We won the damn Cold War. We got the biggest, most vibrant economy on Earth. So why, for God's sake, would it count for so little? Right. And so what's going on is our policy analysts are trying to figure this out. And here's the diagnosis that you get from some of the first letters. This is an incredible reason, like this last week. And in terms of diagnosis, there are three major issues. The first issue is that we've seen the collapse of Wilsonian idealism. Most of the presidents of the United States want to have the League of Nations based on some fundamental principles of democracy, international law, and self-determination. Those don't work anymore. And what happened is we've noticed things like, in 1956 when Hungary was invaded, Eisenhower just turned his back on it. Or just walked away. That was like the first time he was. And then in Latin America, we find ourselves supporting people like Noriega and Pinochet. Right? That's happening. These are real policy choices that are taking place. And what happened is the pragmatic foreign policy of the post-Cold War world with the last superpower is a world where Wilsonian theories are ideally associated with our foreign policy and no longer holding true. That's why, people like Fukuyama go, this is the end of history. That's why they say these things. They say these things because all these principles are no longer true. Now, if that's true, it's kind of interesting how it might affect this topic. This wrote about this old theory. Hell, this topic was written 2 years ago, right? This is old theory. And this old theory may no longer apply. Self-determination has almost been banished from our public policy lexicon. Taiwan, you notice? Taiwan used to be China. It ain't China anymore. It's that other territory. Right? Even Clinton, this rhetoric, is referring to it as like the other China. Right, the PRC is not the China. That's completely reversal. Tibet, hello. What happened to it? It's gone. Dalai Lama just runs around the country trying to raise money and trying to run a country that doesn't exist anymore. Palestinian territories, you see that map? It's terrible. Area A, B, and C, they have faith. It's nuts. It's nuts. It's not going anywhere. The Kurds, hello. Remember, they're in Turkey, they're in Iraq, they're nowhere. There's no self-determination. Kosovo is nuts. Right? Kosovo is part of Serbia. It is. I'm sorry, that's where it is. Right? And right now, what do? We've supported them, and now they're talking about running American forces against the Kosovo Liberation Army to take them down after we took the Serbians out, which is kind of interesting, because I'm not sure we're going to live there. The second answer to this is that Friedanian economics, Friedan, Milton Friedan, Mr. Economics, argued that we have to have open markets. That was his theory. Like open markets are good. Free trade is good. That's still free. Friedanian economics is a disaster. Clinton, Greenspan, and Rubin, right, promoted open markets and free-flowing capitalism. That's what the Clinton administration did. What happened? Too many nations rushed in too quickly to embrace that tourist dream, but the problem was their economies were corrupt. That's what the problem was. So when you open up the markets, you provided more opportunities for the corruption. Right? It really was an open free market. Also, billions of dollars and billions of other currencies were thrown into privatization, where they had no infrastructure for privatization. That's why you had the Asia contagion. That's why it collapsed. That's why you have Russian gravitization, I call that word, which is a gangster state. Right? Just grab everything you can. That's exactly what's going on there. This is what blowback is. These two concepts. Right? It's like backlash, but it's called blowback. You know, and what these people who were talking about the economic world are saying is that the countries that went along were people like countries like Indonesia and Thailand who got screwed. Right? They're referred to as the ghosts being led to the slaughter. They just got screwed. Their economy was a disaster. China, on the other hand, said no, we're not going to buy into this remaining economic. Russia did. Now, most recently, over the last few weeks, Russia is looking towards China. When the United States bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, Chairman Mirden traveled to China. Two countries also have drawn a joint front against NATO and Brussels. This ain't too good. This is bad news, folks. Right? And this is an economic problem. The third and final theory of the momentum collapse of the power, this whole concept of blowback, has to deal with the complete rejection of the Powell Doctrine. Remember Powell, Desert Storm, general, African American, everybody wants him to be president because he's sort of African American. Powell said, use overwhelming force only in situations where victory is near certain or where there's a negative strategy. That's what he came to storm. That was rejected. Because Albright's policy is called assertive multilateralism, which is diplomacy that's backed by force or threat of force. We may not have the capability to do that. I think you know that. I mean, we're overstretched now. So what's going on is that there's been a backlash, blowback, which is the term we're using. There's been a blowback to American foreign policy. And the blowback to American foreign policy is probably due to the fact that Wilsonian idealism sacrifices the whole premise of American foreign policy for centuries. For Romanian economics collapsed when it happened to look at the people of Russia in the story. Right? And if you happen to debate Russia last year, you should for sure. And the complete rejection of the Powell Doctrine by Alternate. So things are changing drastically. Which is my complaint about the debate resolution, my complaint about everything. But my complaint about the debate resolution is this is a lot of forward thinking. This becomes important when we start talking about Virginia later. Because this whole topic is it's a post-Cold War fantasy. You know, a peace and happiness can take place with big superpowers backing off and embracing the world. You know, and the implications are questionable. Now, when we come back at 1 o'clock, we don't come back here, do we? Where do we go? 207 Lafayette. That's really important. Now, those people who are here, who are fellows, aren't people who are self-selected fellows. They're people who are accepted as fellows. Now, if you are a self-selected fellow, in other words, you have too much experience to come to these basic lectures we give, then you need to get it okayed by me. I will okay it if you have good reason, but you can't just choose to go elsewhere. I need to know where you happen to be. Questions on this lecture before I let you go? Yes, sir.
Where is
Lafayette? Off the door on the right. That's where Lafayette is. No questions with all this stuff. Yeah. I think we can go. Where? Floyd Spence, South Carolina. From Columbia. D-L-O-W-D-A-C-K. And German Germany. It's one of those weird terms we know people are going to run with. It sounds a little good. It doesn't sound like backlash, but it's a little bit like it.